Hello and welcome to Barkley and Barton on Manchester United. We're blazing our way through a post-war history on the Red Devils. It's me, Matt Beadle, here with Paddy Barkley, renowned but retired sports journalist. Hello,
Absolutely.
Paddy.
Absolutely. Hi, good evening. Good evening, everybody.
Great to have you here. Wayne Barton, United historian and author. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Matt. Good evening. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Episode 7, we shall move on to, fellas. It's post-Fergie.
This is Love Sport.
Okay, gents, post-Fergie, what a time to be alive. Or perhaps not for some Manchester United fans. Wayne, I'll come to you first. May 2013, the chosen one, David Moyes.
Yeah, it came as a massive shock, didn't it? Sir Alex retiring. I mean, in his 70s, early 70s at that point, and he was thinking he's still going to go on forever, even though you know his end is inevitable, the end of his reign. Yeah. It was a massive shock. I can remember hearing about it. It was like, there was a murmur the day before, wasn't there? The news broke. And then about 9:30 in the morning, the day after, is when it was made official. It was absolutely astonishing.
I suppose because he'd threatened it twice before, well, once seriously and once because he was holding the club to ransom, as employees do. But, you know, that probably contributed to the feeling that he would just go on forever, didn't it?
Yeah, that you thought he would announce it.
Yeah.
You would have some kind of notice, some kind of preparation for it. So it was a bombshell. He was going in a matter of weeks. Mm. Well, a matter of days, wasn't it, really? Yeah. A couple of weeks. And the turnaround of hiring the successor was so fast as well that it did make your head spin quite a lot. Yeah.
Were you, as a United fan, pleased with Moyes?
I know we'll talk about Mourinho a little later.
Yeah.
He would have been my choice for the reasons I'll go into.
Yeah.
In terms of Moyes at the time, I kind of react positively to the news in terms of you can't do anything to change it. You're a supporter. This is the hand that you dealt with. You try and get behind the manager because it's the choice that they've made. You try and look in all the positive things that they were saying, cut from the same cloth, that he had a similar upbringing. He
was Scottish, and anointed. I mean, Matt, for you also, as with Man United, your blood runs red. Did you think trust Fergie? If Fergie's appointed this guy, he'll be fine, especially with a six-year contract.
100%. That's exactly what I thought. I was there on that final day of the season when he said his farewells, and I just thought that it was the logical choice at the time. And whether I convinced myself to believe that, I don't know. Like you said, because it's Fergie, and Fergie we trust, he makes always the right decisions. And I just thought, again, Scottish, Sir Matt, Fergie, this is meant to be.
Yeah. Be honest, I mean, we're all sort of wise after the event, but for me as a neutral, when Van Gaal was appointed, I thought, yes, they've got it right this time. When Mourinho was appointed, I thought, well, maybe it's a bit late. Maybe they should have gone for him first time round, but they were never going to anyway because they had reservations about style of play. Each of them, when they were appointed, seemed, they must have a that seems to make sense. So, you know, we have to, I suppose we have to be careful about being, you know, wise after the event and saying they made wrong choices.
With David Moyes, although he was a great manager at Everton, I thought that his time for a big job was probably 2 years earlier than when he left Everton. I think his stock had already begun to fall a little bit. I think he was holding on for maybe... He was always tipped for Arsenal or United, wasn't he?
And yes.
I think that the fact that United came around was a little bit late for him.
I mean, I know that at that time... I mean, Ferguson won the league, finished a champion, which I think was probably also played a part in his thinking. He didn't want to finish not having won a trophy. And he finished a champion, but he finished with the probably, I mean, I'm open to correction by you boys, but he finished with probably, arguably, his worst champion team of his entire reign.
Yeah, I think in terms of, I mean...
Or at least good. I mean, obviously, they won the league because they're the best, but I don't think they were a great side, his final.
The final one, I mean, they had some great players in there. I mean, Ferdinand, Vidic and Evra, but you're talking about Vidic and Evra.
Towards the end.
Yeah, of 2013 as opposed to 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I still believe it was a better squad than most people believe he left behind. I think, you know, when is a good time.
Yeah. But Moyes was looking at that time. I don't think he was thinking, I'd like to take over this. In fact, I know that he wasn't looking forward to taking over that squad. He did not feel that it was the right time. But as he's said more than once since, when Manchester United come, you don't say no in case they don't never come back again. So he took it, but I think he took it knowing that he was in big, big trouble. Not only taking over from arguably the greatest, but taking over at a time when the bequest, you see, I thought, and I remember writing, I overrated the bequest. I said he's leaving him great players like Adnan Januzaj. You see? I mean, how could you get that so wrong? Because you don't know. You don't know the boy. You don't know how he's going to develop. And so I thought he was leaving a great legacy, but as it turned out, he wasn't. And Moyes, as a manager, as opposed to a journalist, would have known that. I think he felt that he'd have been better off in an ideal world waiting for somebody else to take what you might call the Wilf McGuinness role as the immediate successor, and then taking over after that.
When he arrived at United, his famous first words were something like, "The blood drained from my face when Sir Alex told me I'd got the job," which tells you everything you need to know about how prepared he was for that. Yep. And I think in terms of where he got the job and started in it, he seemed to make a number of rash decisions, which you wouldn't normally associate with Moyes because he was such a good long-term planner at Everton.
Absolutely.
But because he was at United, it came round a bit of a rush. He was making these impulsive decisions based on...
buying comfort blankets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like Fellaini, and it tried for Baines.
Yeah.
And, so he wanted to bring his best two players from Everton, which is... a sign of desperation, definitely. But Fellaini, I think, came on the last day.
Well, it was a complete shambles because the clause had expired in his contract, so they paid Wayne, more than 4 or 5 million than they should have actually paid for him.
And obviously he was aware of that in the contract. He would have known of that. And if he was such a primary target, which maybe he was, but the noises we were led to believe, and let's put this on record as well, this was the summer where United went social on social media. Yes. Everything became more public. Yes. Ed Woodward was doing everything in public. He was briefing everyone because it was his first summer in the role. He wanted it to go off with a bang, and it went with a whimper.
Yes. I know it's been said many, many times before, but, you know, Moyes, if David Gill had remained and Ferguson on the football club board, I think sometimes these chief executives are only appreciated after they've gone. And I think Gill going at the same time and this complete novice, Woodward, coming in, doubled the difficulty because, you know, you need a manager. People have often talked about the role of David Dean in the background with Arsene Wenger at Arsenal and how Arsenal's results changed after Dean was forced out of the club and Wenger no longer had his daily input. I think, although Gill wasn't a football man in the same way as Dean, he was a massive influence in terms of general wisdom on the club. And that was another thing that conspired against Moyes.
I think the lack of preparation as well might have prompted knee-jerk decisions maybe from David Moyes. And yes, I think that's potentially where he let himself down, was the going in and thinking, right, I need to be my own man. You can just picture it, him rocking up into the office first time saying, right, I'm going to take all the pictures down and I'm going to get rid of Mickey Phelan. I'm going to get rid of René Meulensteen, bringing, you know, Jimmy Lumsden in, bringing in Steve Round, bringing in Phil Neville to an extent. I remember seeing, Wayne, just a video clip of Phil Neville on the training ground speaking to these players, and they're all sat on the floor, and I thought, it just doesn't seem right.
Mm. But this is what we said in the earlier episode, that it's exactly the Wilf McGuinness theory of the players who've achieved so much, you aren't going to listen. And I know Phil Neville had, but Moyes hadn't, Lumsden hadn't, Round hadn't, so they weren't going to listen to them. I described that in the book that I wrote on this era. I described it as a series of understandable mistakes. He brought in his own staff. Any manager would do that. But in hindsight, because they needed the experience of Mullenstein,
Exactly, the impulse to bring your own people is not just, as we said before, the comfort blanket syndrome. It's also decency, because a manager who takes his people, you know, after all, these people had uprooted themselves to go to Everton. I think Round had only been there 4 or 5 years, something like that. And there is a sort of moral imperative. You don't have to follow it, but if you can, it's nice. And he trusted round and didn't want to break the promise that no doubt he'd made to them. Listen, if I leave, I'm not going to leave you here to get hung out to dry. I'm going to take you wherever I go. And I don't know, I can't be sure that that happened in that case, but I've always assumed so.
I think there was an unfamiliarity of Moyes with the United squad. He wasn't aware of some of the players' schedules, the fitness schedules. I think Ferdinand was used sparingly in the title-winning season, and he was burnt out within weeks of of Moyes arriving. And he looked like a burnt-out player, and that was unfair on Ferdinand because he was a Rolls-Royce of a defender. He's absolutely magnificent. So he didn't get the end that his career befitted. The same with Carrick in respect as well. He didn't have the awareness that Raphael had come on as the best right back in that team, and he immediately put Phil Jones there, and I think Phil Jones he'd struggled to impact a position and to find a place, but he was playing in holding midfield, wasn't he? He played against Real Madrid and everyone was thinking this is where he's going to end up. So he had all these problems where he wasn't familiar with the players, he wasn't familiar with their schedules and the training, and I think because he wanted to do things his own way, that immediately undermined what he was trying to do.
I would think, you know, if you look at the legacy, and that you can't make much legacy in under 10 months, but which is all he lasted. He did buy Juan Mata, which is a signing, whatever you may say about not exactly stellar. Try and imagine what it would have been like these last few years if Mata hadn't been at the club. You know, he provides that quality, not always as an automatic choice, but as a, we can rely on him. He's not going to let us down. I think that actually has been a good signing. But when you compare it with David's record at Everton, where, to be fair, he had a better backup than he had at Manchester United. You know, signing players, you know, Lescott, Jagielka, Tim Cahill, signing them for peanuts and selling them for absolute fortunes. And Fellaini, by the way, would also, I suppose, come into that category, although they did pay 14 million and only got 28 from United. But Pienaar, Leighton Baines himself, you know. So, I mean, brilliant signing record. And he just didn't have time to replicate that, or backup to replicate that at Manchester United. And that's basically what I'll remember of the David Moyes era.
Carrick, Erst to shoot, which is down! 2 goals in a minute and a half! Moyes pumping his fist, and Old Trafford explodes!
Well, I wonder, will that prove to be David Moyes' Sheffield Wednesday moment? And it's Kieran Richardson! And Darren Bent, it's 2-2!
The most asked question is I get everywhere I go is, what would you do different, David? And I say to people, I wouldn't do anything different. I've got some small things I might have in hindsight, you know, looked and tried to make sure I kept one of the staff, which Alex had, which I did try to do, and no, I'd never regret taking Manchester United. If the job came up again today, I'd take it in a minute. It's, for me, I've not been at Real Madrid as a manager, but I've seen Manchester United, and for me it's the best club in the world as far as support, everything around it, what they've got.
This is Love Sport.
Barclay and Barton on a post-war history of Manchester United. We are focusing on the post-Fergie era. David Moyes was out at the end of 2014 for a very brief period. It was Ryan Giggs.
Yep.
And then, of course, Louis van Gaal entered the building, chaps.
Mm. Well, a massive CV. Van Gaal had trophies. He'd won. He started off with Ajax, won the European Cup, did very well with Holland, finishing third in the World Cup. So basically, most places he'd gone, he'd been a success. Moreover, loves kids. So that's ticking the Busby legacy of Ferguson boxes. Always believes in attractive football. Ditto, ticking both of those boxes. You might say arrogant, ticking a third.
You might.
And I'm being brave saying it with two United fans. But no, I mean, he seemed to be, if there was a feeling that the job was slightly too big for David Moyes, you certainly wouldn't imagine that any job would overawe Louis van Gaal. So he came in and looked like, Did he look it to you? To you two boys? He looked it to me.
It's funny you say that about the media, because we've talked about the personality of managers them needing to have that kind of front, and probably more than even Mourinho, more than any manager in the post-Ferguson era, he did not stand for anything with the press. He played the press on his own terms.
Yes.
He was that experienced at dealing with it, and he also played the language barrier very well with that, didn't he? He would always be careful. He would always want things clarified.
Yep.
He'd have arguments with journalists in press conferences to make sure that what he was saying was being understood.
Absolutely.
And I love that. And the idea was, and Matt, you might correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure that the idea was when he came in, he would be a sort of caretaker, you know, for Ryan Giggs to come in and succeed him.
That's right.
And the idea was that, and it's erroneous to look at now, but it's one of those hindsight things that we believed in at the time, was, well, Barcelona were great now, and Bayern Munich at the time were unbelievable. They were playing unbelievable football, and the idea was that he'd laid the foundations for that kind of football, which wasn't correct, but we all believed it. You know, because obviously, he was famously chased out of Bayern Munich, wasn't he? The director there was saying awful things about him. But when he arrived at United, we all sort of, again, we indulged in it, we all believed in it. And I don't know if you remember, but the first pre-season, the football was incredible. Mm. He was playing a lot of kids, and we were believing.
Promoted Rashford, didn't he?
Not at that time.
Well, the left back first, you know, the
Cameron Borthwick Jackson.
Yes, exactly.
Those players came in a little later into the season when there was the injury crisis. But he was doing that in the pre-season with the likes of it was a Tyler Blackett. Paddy McNair was the one as well. So a few players like that, and Andreas Pereira was also. He was in that early mix-up, and they were playing good football, but there wasn't any transfer activity going on. Apart from the outgoings, so we lost a lot of experience that summer because of how things ended with Moyes. So you had Evra going on a free transfer or for a nominal fee. Mm. Ferdinand left to QPR for nothing. Vidic left for nothing. Ryan Giggs was on. He retired that summer, didn't he? Ryan Giggs retired. Added to that, Scholes had obviously previously retired. There was around 3,000 games of top level experience lost, and then the players that he brought in didn't have any English league experience, so the likes of Rojo, Di Maria,
Herrera.
Falcao, Herrera. I know Luke Shaw was brought in, but he was sort of like an interim signing, wasn't he, at the time?
Di Maria didn't want to be there, I don't think.
No, absolutely not.
He got certain things right on the face of it. I mean, the word in the game at that time was that Ryan Giggs was going to be a world-class coach.
Yeah.
Really was. So he was the perfect man. You talked about a sort of caretaker role for Van Gaal because he was no spring chicken. Seeing Giggs next to him, you know, was at first seemed like, oh, this is brilliant. The club is in safe hands. All the traditions are being observed. And then you look, after a while, did you not worry about the body language? Giggs never, he seemed to be staring into the abyss, Giggs, and not communicating with Van Gaal.
They seemed obviously disconnected. I remember there was a lot of talk about that, and it was that Van Gaal wasn't as animated as Giggs, that Giggs would be the one on the touchline giving the orders, whereas Van Gaal would be looking at the clipboard.
Yeah, but that was always his style, actually. He was a delegator. In fact, you know, to digress slightly, he accelerated the development of Jose Mourinho by giving him, because when Jose Mourinho was at Barcelona, Van Gaal promoted him actually more than Bobby Robson had and gave him work to do. So that was part of his style. And you would have thought that Ryan Giggs would have embraced that, but he didn't.
Yeah. I think the thing with Van Gaal is there was a lot of Sexton in him. If you to compare the eras, in that he was teaching the players again. Yes. He was telling them, you have to do it exactly my way.
Yes, which is zonal, and they were used to sort of
the circulation,
more freedom.
And the circulation of the ball, he seemed to be very stuck on this. You've got to move the ball within two or three touches.
Yeah.
I remember the first game.
I always believed that.
The first game we played against Swansea, the first competitive game, we're playing in the first half and Chris Smalling gets the ball. He takes a touch and he's panicking.
Yeah.
He was panicking straight away because he didn't know where to pass the ball and he knew that he needed to pass it.
Yeah.
And that was indicative. That one little thing in that first game was indicative of how the players feared playing under Van Gaal, and it was terrible. I mean, the football, as a result, as a consequence, because these were players who were perhaps should have been trusted to play with their instinct a little bit better, a little bit more than what Van Gaal did do. But then that's why you've hired Van Gaal, isn't it, to teach them to improve. And obviously they've shown under Moyes that they weren't good enough, so there was an element of contrast there that, you know, they did have to... The players needed to step up, but maybe Van Gaal's unfamiliarity with the British game also came at a cost.
I think the defining Giggs moment for me was when Van Gaal did the dive on the touchline. Yeah. Giggs just walked away instantly, just turned around and said, I'm having absolutely none of that.
Yeah.
And to just very quickly go back to your question about what we thought when he came in, Paddy.
Yeah.
For me, it was the 2014 World Cup at the time, because although he masterminded that emphatic win over Spain
in
that opening game, I think it was, towards the end of that tournament, some of the football that the Dutch were playing was turgid. I think in their last two games, they were 0-0 draws.
Yeah,
I know, again, he had the nous to bring on
Tim Krul
for Jasper Cillessen.
In the last minute of extra time.
In the penalty shootout.
Which I would have thought was a plus. I know it was, but everybody had low-scoring games against Costa Rica. You know, that was how Costa Rica progressed as much as they did.
I think part of that as well was what he did really do well was bring in Frans Hoek as the goalkeeper coach, and he really developed David De Gea. I know De Gea credits Eric Steele, who was responsible for bringing David De Gea to the club, but Frans Hoek, I think, really pushed him on.
Yeah, he became the best goalkeeper in the world around that time. But because he was really the only player who was pulling, as I say, pulling his weight is a little bit unfair, but he was the only player justifying his reputation. A lot of players were declining, and the players who were brought in weren't doing anything spectacular, and maybe that was to do with the tactics, because, you know, it was abysmal. I know he had the injuries, he brought in some young players as well, but he never seemed to know what his side was. There was never an opportunity to have a settled side, and never an opportunity to have a settled defence. I remember that there was some infamy about that. There was never a settled defence, never really a settled area of the pitch, you know, a strike force or anything like that. He wanted to play Rooney in midfield sometimes. He also made the cardinal error, which we haven't really talked about so far, and I don't want to sort of dig Wayne Rooney out too much, but David Moyes needed a big win because of how badly it was going, and his big win was to secure Wayne Rooney on a 5-year contract, which hamstrung United. It was the start of United's terrible financial decisions, that, because Rooney at that point, I mean, that was a golden handshake from Ferguson to Moyes, say, you can sell him and nobody's going to think any badly of you. But he kept him, gave him massive contracts, and then Van Gaal's famous statement was, my captain is undroppable. And then Rooney was playing like... we saw his sad decline as a top-level player. I mean, that kind of thing was... All these kind of things were going on under Van Gaal. The football was terrible. But I did feel sorry for him in the middle of his second season when Jose Mourinho was sacked, because it seemed straight away that the PR machine was ramping up to take him to United. Van Gaal was having massive arguments with the press around Christmas time.
Yeah.
And I think the players stopped playing for him for a little while. They expected that sacking to come. So there's some of the worst performances I've ever seen at United were around that period. The ironic thing was, he had that stay of execution, because obviously there'd been some kind of agreement with Woodward and Mourinho that said, well, we'll come at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So Van Gaal had this little stay of execution where everything went his way for like just a little period. So
they had that victory over City, didn't they? Was that
I don't know if it was, but it was when
they beat City 4-2, and they beat Liverpool with Juan Mata's brilliant overhead bicycle kick as well, which I remember at the time Gary Neville saying that was one of the best Manchester United performances he's ever seen.
Yes.
It was at Anfield. Because they played, the thing what Ferguson used to hate was when his United team would play with fear at Anfield, but he kind of instilled that a little bit anyway, because he made it feel like Anfield was a scary place to go.
Yeah.
But they, under Van Gaal, they never played with fear at Anfield. That's one positive thing to come out of it. But around that time when we beat Arsenal, when Marcus Rashford came into side and he threw himself on the floor and everything, even though the football wasn't great, there was a backs to the wall attitude because of those youngsters coming in and doing so well. Fosu Mensah was another one who played brilliantly.
Yes.
And the cup run, it was galvanising a little bit like 1990. It felt, you know, like there might be something in this for Van Gaal. Crazily, this feeling around United was actually pretty good. And then he wins the cup final.
Yeah.
And possibly the most disgraceful thing that's ever happened in my lifetime as a United fan. I still, it makes my stomach turn to think about what happened to him on that day. Really changed the way that I see the club in many ways. But if
Woodward had, with the Glazers' assent, had made the decision to make a change at the end of the season, they couldn't go to Jose Mourinho, or I'm being devil's advocate here, could they have gone to Jose Mourinho and say, we think it be a bit tawdry to sack Louis van Gaal now. Could you wait a bit, please?
Would Jose Mourinho have waited?
No, of course not. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, are we going to lambast Ed Woodward for one of his better decisions? If indeed it was that. I just think it's a bit... It was certainly inconvenient that Van Gaal won the cup. Do you think that if they had left it a month, it would have been less distasteless than waiting 2 days with the newspapers already writing he's finished?
It's a difficult one. That's hindsight, isn't it?
Just the circumstances that sickened you.
The fact that he was going up to to pick the cup up and they were already briefing, it was like breaking news on everywhere.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing outside Wembley Stadium that day. I remember walking past and there were United fans, and whether we can call them real United fans or not, singing Jose Mourinho's name. Could not believe it.
I was in Disneyland in California, and we were watching the game on the big screen outside the ESPN bar. So we watched the game, and I sort of clicked on Twitter to just see how everyone was celebrating, and it was just Mourinho in, literally as the final whistle went. And I was like, that can't be right. And it didn't feel right. It didn't feel right to me. And I think part of that stems from the fact that Van Gaal, to me, although his football was terrible for large portions, I just liked him as a character. He had a certain thing about him. It may have been that arrogance, you know. He was just likable to me. I really did like him.
I mean, my dealings as a journalist, I came across him only twice. And the first time was when he was with Ajax. And the second time was while I was researching a book about Jose Mourinho. And particularly on the latter occasion, he as a person, he just couldn't do enough. He's spent ages speaking. He was in his house near Barcelona, the Sitges near Barcelona, where Jose Mourinho also lived, and he talked for an hour. Then he said he gave me his email address so that if I needed any more, he just couldn't have been nicer. Yes, he's got this awful pompous image, but personally, I've heard this from Dutch people as well, that he's by no means as arrogant as he looks, and he's not a bad lad.
And a lot of times I use the word horny to my players, because it's not in the books that somebody has to grab with the hair, and only in sex masochism. Then it is allowed. And De Gea was never champion, so not many players, Rooney, Carrick, they have been the champions once and maybe more than once. When you analyze the games, we have twitched our ass on the bench. And last year, the third captain was Mr. Mike Smalling.
Chris,
sorry. And after that, Michael Smalling has saved us. Yeah, but...
Louis van Gaal's Red Army!
Come on, Louis, can we have one from you? Louis van Gaal's Red Army.
Louis van Gaal's Red Army!
This is Love Sport.
This is Barclay and Barton on a post-war history of Manchester United. We're delving into the post-Fergie era at the club. We've done David Moyes, we've done Louis van Gaal, and then immediately, as you just said, Wayne, after that FA Cup final win over Crystal Palace in 2016, it was van Gaal out and Jose Mourinho.
Look, there was a lot of divided opinion about Mourinho, whether or not he would contrast too much with the United philosophy, as Paddy said earlier, that he wasn't considered in 2013 when it was Charlton and Ferguson. They were sort of like hesitant to give him the job. But for me, I always felt it was an inevitability that he would end up at United. So it would have probably been better for him to go there in 2013. Mm. So it was a case of right man, wrong time. I think when he went from Real Madrid to Chelsea, I think if he'd gone from Real Madrid to United, and this was a time when United desperately needed that, as we saw what happened in the summer, because they weren't able to convince anyone to join them. Certainly not Fabregas, who did eventually go to Chelsea. And United did need this. He would have made moving from Real Madrid to Manchester United look like a step up. Mm-hmm. That's how it would have been portrayed. And I think the media would have bought into that. And United would have desperately needed that, because that was a time when, obviously, Real Madrid just went and pilfered all the best players, everyone, everywhere. So United would have turned the tables on that a little bit. That was the famous summer where Gareth Bale left as well. So you never know what might have happened with mm-hmm. that. Yes, so I tried to see... You know, I liked Mourinho as a personality. I know that you don't, Matt, but I did at the same time. I felt like his dealings with United had always been a little bit more courteous than with other clubs.
Yes, you're not kidding, because it was his dream job. I always wanted the Manchester United job. It went back, really, I think, to when he learned so much from Sir Alex Ferguson. The first time was when, I think it was Mark Hughes was going... I can't remember which way, but Ferguson went over to Barcelona with Martin Edwards to do the deal. Mourinho at that time was the interpreter for Barcelona. And so he sat in on these negotiations, and he remembered seeing Ferguson's style in the negotiations, how he was fighting for to get the right deal for Manchester United and so on. And that was the first time he sort of fell under the spell to an extent of Ferguson. Then they, of course, met again at Porto. First leg, Roy Keane was sent off, treading on the goalkeeper accidentally. And then after that game, Mourinho told the story of how Ferguson raced after the referee and followed him all the way up the tunnel in his ear all the time. You know, that conspired in his quest to become Manchester United manager. So it was a dream job, and that's why he was always careful never to get involved in a fight with Ferguson and Manchester United in general. If you look back over all the cuttings, he's criticised referees, he's criticised TV schedulers, he's everybody, interviewers, everybody, but never Manchester United.
Yeah, politically engineered, wasn't it, that move? Yes. Especially
called him the boss, didn't he? Always used to call him the boss.
Yeah, well that's the reverence with what Paddy was saying, the reverence in which he was held. And also, he'd been boss of Real Madrid, and when they'd knocked out United, and Nani had controversially been sent off, and I think Mourinho had said something like, the better team lost, which he never did anywhere apart from United when that happened. So... when he did sign for United and he became manager, we were at a low ebb anyway. The football we'd seen was terrible. It couldn't make it any worse than what we'd seen under Van Gaal. We'd seen boring football, pragmatic football, but Mourinho knew how to win with boring and pragmatic football. And United, more than good football, needed success at that time. They really did. And he brought that. So in some respects, you could argue that certainly in the first season, that he was successful in doing what he needed to do. I mean, he sort of restored United, being a little bit tougher to beat and everything like that.
Gave him a trophy.
Two trophies.
Yeah.
And I thought at the time, because of that, you know, I looked on, again, you look back with hindsight and you think, well, you're giving these managers the benefit of the doubt. I looked at those earlier times with Chelsea, where Robin and Duff were playing on the wings and they played good football. I thought Real Madrid...
fantastic football, yeah.
Real Madrid played some good football under him sometimes. I know not all the time, but they scored... There was a season where they scored over 100 goals.
Ozil flourished under him, you know, and you would think, you know... And they broke the John Toshack's goal-scoring, you know... A record for goals scored in a league season at Real Madrid.
There was a part of me, Paddy, that thought, having taken this United job and having covered it for so long,
he thought, I'll give them what they want.
I would have thought at some point
he did at Real Madrid. Yeah. He said, "Listen, if they want attacking football, I'll break the goal scoring record."
Yeah,
and I thought he was going to do the same at United.
I thought they would be a fork in the road, similar to the one that we've already discussed on an earlier show with Doherty and the conversation that allegedly took place with him and Busby, where someone would have pulled into one side and said, "Look, things aren't going well at the minute. We're not enjoying your football."
Yeah,
but
go down in style.
Go down in style. Go, just change your style and see what happens. And at the at the start of his second season, where he brought in Lukaku and he brought in Matic, they were calling United 4-0 FC. So winning 4-0 every week. Now, obviously, where it pains to, I think both of us will admit, the football wasn't great, but it was Mourinho ball at its best at United. They were killing teams off. They showed a clinical side that was as good as it was going to get at United under Mourinho, and I would have been happy with that if it had brought trophies, you know, because at that point, like I said, success was what we needed more than entertaining football.
Yeah.
Although towards the end I was more like, I just want to watch entertaining football again. Yeah. But that's because of all of the controversy.
But do you remember, if you look back to that first trophy, which was the League Cup, where United beat Southampton, and my word, if United, when was it that United were very unlucky to lose to Arsenal in a cup final?
2005.
At the Millennium Stadium. Mm. It was a joke result. Well, in my opinion, Manchester United 3, Southampton 2 was as big a joke. I mean, the Italian centre-forward scored twice, was denied a third with almost a Scholesian against Porto offside that wasn't. So it was, I thought that was, and but afterwards, you know, who cares if you win the cup, the result, all that matters is you're holding up the cup. But do you remember Mourinho? He looked utterly miserable. Mm. He stood aside from the team, and you thought, well, maybe he's saying they won it, you know, give the boys the credit, but it wasn't that. He looked petulant, a petulant child.
But not in the same way that, I mean, there's a famous story of Ferguson at Aberdeen where they won a cup against Rangers and he killed them for the
that's
display.
That's right, yeah. But they, I can't remember, I think it was 4 days after they won the Cup Winners' Cup, beating Real Madrid in Gothenburg. And he said, right, you know, you can have your 24 hours of celebration, but we've got this big. And they didn't turn it on. They won, but didn't turn it on. And he gave them absolute pelters on TV. There was a bit of... And he apologised for it to them and publicly. But with Mourinho, it was never explained why he looked so miserable.
And he was, you're right, he was petulant then. I remember him holding up the cup and sort of doing a mini wave to the fans.
But it was
and
almost sarcastic.
It was. But then at the Europa League final, you went to the absolute ridiculous, where he's holding up the three fingers and getting and going round all the players, do the three fingers, and you're thinking, three fingers, what three fingers for? And he's accounting for the Europa League, the Carabao Cup and the Community Shield. It's absolutely ridiculous. It just made the club a laughing stock.
And the other thing I would tie in with that bizarre moodiness was, whereas he'd, even in the second spell, he'd sort of swaggered around London and Surrey, you know, as Chelsea manager. In Manchester, he was a sort of shrunken figure in a shell suit, living out of a suitcase in the Lowry Hotel. And I thought, how on earth can you be manager of Manchester United and not uproot? You know?
Almost like a caricature in some respects. Yeah.
So he never settled in Manchester, and it just seemed that he was, you know, never happier than he was clambering on the flight back to London.
And the strangest thing for me then, with all that in mind, because I mean at this sort of December point of his third season, was it third season? His second season,
yeah.
The December point, United were miles behind Chelsea, City in the league, and they awarded him a new 3-year contract.
Yes.
Now, regardless of whether or not you thought he was the right man for the job, they committed to giving him 3 years.
Yeah.
So that was December, January time. By June, he and Woodward had spectacularly fallen out.
Yeah.
I can't understand what went wrong from January. They must have discussed transfer targets for them to be on such a different page come June.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the window, they're both briefing the press different things. It was unbelievable. And from that point, so I always err on the side of the manager with this. So regardless of who it is, I felt that they should have backed the manager with what he wanted. Yeah. Even if he wanted to get rid of Martial, as you know, Woodward allegedly intervened and said, no, I want to keep him and give him a new contract.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest fights. I always feel back the manager and let him make his mistakes and then sack him if you disagree with it.
But that's what you're saying is fundamental to Manchester United tradition. You know, I mean, it was laid down by Busby, if anything, emphasised by Ferguson. The manager is in control.
Yeah.
I mean, Ferguson used the word control more than any other in his speeches.
Was the name of his book was called Leading, wasn't it? And it was basically 100,000 words about control.
About control, exactly. And Matt Busby, despite his avuncular image, was just as fundamental as that. I mean, right from the minute he took over, he got rid of two of his best players in the 1948 team. Two of the best players, Morris and Mitten, just because he had to establish the iron fist of control over Manchester United. So, you know, that was as fundamental to the nature of the club. And also, the other thing, the other rule that Mourinho broke, and he broke a massive number. Why Woodward gave him that contract, I do not know, because he was breaking every rule. There was the time when United were beaten, I think, by Seville in the Champions League. Round of 16, and the press said afterwards, you know, you must be bitterly disappointed. And he shrugged and he said, well, you know, Manchester United don't have a divine right to win. You know, loads of teams have won here. I won here. And, of course, he was referring to the Porto game, you know, and Costinha's last-minute goal. That sounded dreadful because he was putting the club above himself. And that is that's another rule broken. Because, you know, even Ferguson... Now, Ferguson was a massive egotist. But when Ferguson went out and tapped his watch in the seventh minute, he wasn't tapping it... You felt he was tapping it on behalf of Manchester United, not himself.
Yeah.
And Mourinho just never learned that skill from Sir Alex Ferguson.
Particularly, I mean, him being in it for itself was something that was so prevalent in those last few months. After the transfer window closes in 2018, and he starts making bizarre, bewildering team selections. There was one game where he selected Scott McTominay, a player who everyone remembers, what is it, Mourinho, when he became United manager, held up a list of 50 players that he'd promoted through the youth academy. But McTominay was one that he deserved credit for bringing in and giving a chance.
Yes.
And he'd come on leaps and bounds under Mourinho. He'd done brilliantly. But then he started playing him at centre-half. I think he hung him out to dry against West Ham because he didn't get a centre-half in the transfer window. So he played him against West Ham. He played poorly, as you would expect. United were heavily beaten. And these kind of decisions were made on a weekly basis. He dropped Pogba, spectacularly fell out with him. I think this is alleged, but he called him a virus after a game against Southampton, which there were little individual circumstances like that, little individual events which were coming up, which I was starting to feel were sackable offences in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, saying that in front of, you know, in front of a dressing room, I thought that's probably one. The way that he was hanging players out to dry wasn't great. I was still shocked when he was sacked, but the time had definitely come for him to go when he was sacked.
It had. I have dug him out a bit on this particular section of the show, so I'm going to finish on a kind of positive, if you will, and that is purely the fact that that season when he finished second, and I was watching that season not so long ago actually, thinking, do you know what, it maybe wasn't as bad as I thought. 81 points they ended up with. Had City not had their incredible campaign with 100 points under Pep Guardiola, that would have equaled Leicester City's title winning campaign in 15-16, and actually would have beaten United's title winning campaign in 2010-11 when they got to 19. So I mean, if I can give him one bit of respect, I would say that is that. But it's staggering, Paddy, to finish. Just that he got to his third season. We have the classic Mourinho third season syndrome, and it was all over.
Poor start. 3-0 home loss to Tottenham will be, I think, uppermost in you two, in the minds of you two. And after that, Jose Mourinho demanded respect from the assembled journalists, saying, holding up three fingers, one for each Premier League trophy he won. And do you remember he said, I've won 3 Premier League trophies. That's more than the 19 other Premier League managers, current managers, combined. True. Arithmetically true. But not well placed. And shortly afterwards, he was gone. A really poor start to 2018-19.
3-0. Do you know what this means? 3-0. But also mean 3 premierships, and I won more premierships alone than the other 19 managers together. 3 for me and 2 for them. Respect, 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 man, respect, respect.
This is Love Sport.
It is Barclay and Barton on a post-war history of Manchester United. Episode 7 is post-Fergie, and we are at the end of the post-Fergie era, or perhaps the new beginning of the post-Fergie era. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Jose Mourinho lost his last game in charge against Liverpool. Quite defining defeat, that one. Mm-hmm. And then Ole Gunnar Solskjaer arrives in town, Paddy, on loan.
Yep.
An on-loan manager. He goes and wins his first game 5-1 against Cardiff, and boom. The good days are back.
Yeah, well, they seem to. I mean, everything seems right. Solskjaer not only is part of the Manchester United furniture as a goal scorer, not only that, he'd learned the coaching trade at Manchester United, worked under Sir Alex Ferguson, taken over the reserves for a couple of years before going to Molde in his native Norway, where he won 2 titles. Okay, not such a great time at Cardiff, where he lasted only 9.5 months. But at Manchester United, absolutely, the man could do no wrong. And that's exactly how it worked out.
Yeah, we'll talk about, I guess, the ownership structure of the club and the involvement of the Glazers and Ed Woodward, who we've really not touched on in this podcast. And I don't think it's right to, because we're talking about the managers. I'm not defending them at all, but I'm talking about the managers and their contribution. Solskjaer came in. And it's important then to recognise the sort of squad that he was walking into. Discounting every member of the squad that Ferguson left and looking at the players that have come and gone since that time, I counted the other day that it was 16 players who've been signed for the first team. A player who's been signed to go straight into the first team and then be a regular starter, 16 have been signed and have already left the club. Mm-hmm. So you play, and that does include Sanchez, but that's like players like Romelu Lukaku, Bastian Schweinsteiger, Morgan Schneiderlin, Angel Di Maria. There are players that, it's just a scattergun transfer policy that didn't seem to have any sort of coherent strategy to it. A very desperate need sometimes to get in a marquee name. There were 4 different managers.
Yep.
This is the squad as a composite of all these different managers with different ideas.
Yeah, and you wondered what the problem was when Solskjaer took over this sort of ragtag and bogtail.
Well, for the first couple of games, because I think he just brought a good feeling back, and his philosophy, as given to him by Sir Alex Ferguson, was express yourself, play football, you're good lads, that's why you're here.
And it worked. I mean, his start, I don't know how many games you measure it, 8-9 games, it was the most successful ever start by a Premier League manager, not only at Manchester United, anywhere since the start of the Premier League era.
He'd lost just once in 17, his opening 17. He won his opening 8. Yeah.
And also those games as well. There were wins at Arsenal in the Cup, Chelsea in the Cup, Spurs in the league. He was winning at big places and tactically outwitting managers. It was like, oh my God, what have we stumbled on here?
But the only way that this great run could be halted was by giving the caretaker a contract. So what did Ed Woodward do?
It's truly an honour, and I think everyone knows how... I've spoke about it the last few months anyway, that this is the dream job for any football-interested man, especially anyone who's been involved in Man United, being given the opportunity now to move the club forward with all the potential there is. It's fantastic. Truly, it's good.
Okay, Wayne, so as things stand, where are Manchester United? Recently signed Bruno Fernandes, of course. My fear is that a certain section of United fans are incredibly impatient and just think that as soon as you sign a new player like Fernandes, suddenly results are going to upturn. And as soon as they don't, oh, we've got to sign someone else and we've got to splash the cash. Also, this is the post-Fergie episode. That spectre of Fergie looming, which seems to be there every single game. The camera, every game without fail, will point to Sir Alex Ferguson in the crowd, home and away. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for Manchester United? And yeah, just sum up where the club are right now.
I think in terms of Ferguson, the argument could be made that he's a spectre because he's always there. I would say that he deserves his place. I think every manager of Manchester United deserves a place in the stands. Every living manager, they deserve to go and watch every single game. They should be made welcome.
Yeah, I think it's the duffers you want to turf out of the place. And Ferguson's always been honest about this, that when he first came to the club, the presence of Sir Matt Busby did not daunt him. In fact, he used Matt Busby. He went in for a cup of tea and listened to him and learned and asked for reassurance and got it, you know. And I really think that a lot of the problems at Manchester United would have been different if relationships had been established with Sir Alex. I thought at first, while Solskjaer was doing so well, my assumption was that that was because he was talking daily to Sir Alex Ferguson in the same way as Sir Alex Ferguson talked almost daily to Sir Matt Busby.
That is happening. Paul Parker, I talked to him regularly, and he saw Ollie and he said that he's in contact with the manager.
So that's a very good reason for keeping Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager.
As for where United are at present, I think, so we're talking in the February international break, and I would say where they are, 5th to 8th position is probably about right for this squad. I think in some respects you've got to remember that Ollie's had a lot of injuries to deal with this season, to the so-called better players, and the squad at its strongest is probably, there might be an argument for it getting in the top 4.
Yes, there is, because what they are is competitive with the best team in the country, Liverpool, you know, and Manchester City on any given day. What they don't have is the all-round strength to win this consistently enough to get into that top 4 places. But there's definitely, as long as you can beat the top clubs, you can sort out the relatively easy bit of beating the lower clubs. It's the other way around that is the difficult part. So I think there's certainly a lot to be optimistic about in terms of Solskjaer.
Love Sport.